And Meryl Streep's honorary Lifetime Award incurred a lengthy and I thought quite good take on the political situation in America. She's a private individual. She can tweet. She can say what she likes. That's the wonder of my country. She has millions and millions and millions of people know her name, and they will listen to what she's got to say. And so she is a valuable platform for any message.
Karen Krzanovich reflecting on that extraordinary speech by Meryl Streep in what's been an extraordinary week. More on that coming up today on The Cinema Show. Also ahead.
The duty falls upon me as a representative of the White House to address the recent altercation between yourself and President-elect Trump.
The White House issues an official apology to Meryl Streep and pleads with her to take up office. Well, not really, but it's a good story. We'll also hear from the filmmaker Eugene Green and a little later.
For the last 3 months of Evita's life, her office was based in this building. And so what they've done is they've recreated it. It's more like an artist's installation, I suppose, than an exact reproduction or a museum of the office.
In tribute to La La Land's record win at the Golden Globes, we'll look back at the classic musical Evita with someone who was lucky enough to stand on that famous balcony. That's all coming up today on The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. Hello from London, I'm Ben Rylan. Awards ceremonies are never far from politics, but this year's Golden Globe Awards seem to take things to a new level. Meryl Streep's emotional speech seemed to summarise everything that the American entertainment industry has been feeling about the president-elect. Perhaps we shouldn't have been surprised when Donald Trump launched an attack on Meryl Streep, but somehow it all still felt incredibly strange. Allow us to present you now with this, a somewhat imagined letter of apology from a White House staffer written in the final days of the world as we know it.
Dear Miss Streep, despite the official nature of this correspondence, I'd be remiss if I didn't begin by expressing my ardent personal appreciation and admiration for your talents, as well as your significant contributions to the legacy of film. Normally, such a personal statement from our office would be seen as impertinent. However, the general consensus around here has seen caution thrown to the wind, as we anticipate the imminent replacement of our staff of 20 with 140 characters. The duty falls upon me, as a representative of the White House, to address the recent altercation between yourself and President-elect Trump. Conventionally, said duty would require me to corroborate the sentiment expressed by the president-elect with mere condemnation of your behavior at the Golden Globes and ostensibly exaggerated acting abilities. This, however, would require me to overlook the vineyard of sour grapes that plagues virtually all White House communication nowadays, not to mention the tension that exists between the president-elect and remaining in-house staff. To say we don't see eye to eye, well, that's putting it mildly. To get a better sense of our current affability, imagine a staring contest waged between a myopic giant and a blind Ewok. A metaphor that I do hope also conveys the abject lack of political correctness that's recently befallen our hallowed halls. It is the raw irony of the president-elect's response that drives the heart of this letter. As if President-elect Trump, a game show star at best, denigrating your acting abilities wasn't enough of an outright injustice, he dared to direct such unfair criticism to a person who, through her sophisticated talents, as well as her humanitarian work, comprises a far better candidate for the American presidency. While clever hair and makeup may have given you Miss Thatcher's appearance, I believe it was your own soul that read General Haig his rights when you defended your position on the Falklands conflict with the memorable, "With all due respect, sir, I have done battle every single day of my life, and many men have underestimated me before. And no one will ever forget how resilient you were in the face of both bureaucracy and misogyny in Silkwood." And although last year's impersonation of old Orange Peel himself at Shakespeare in the Park may have unexpectedly garnered his praise, The last laugh was with you, as it was proof that a woman dressed in all the pomp and powder of the president-elect is capable of earning more respect than the man himself. Those of us left here in the West Wing only see dark days ahead. But what keeps us afloat is the hope that, rather than take this letter merely as the apology it was intended to be, you accept it as something of a nomination. A call to step into the shoes that eluded Claire Underwood, Hillary Clinton, and that short-lived attempt by Gina Davis. In the few remaining moments I have here on Capitol Hill, I shall issue this plea just once. Run, Merrill. Run. Sincerely yours, Strutt Cutman, White House staff.
Dear Merrill, a letter written and performed by Brian Lewandowski. Well, the Golden Globes have always been known as, well, the more fun little cousin of the Oscars. And this year, well, it was certainly entertaining, wasn't it? Even if Jimmy Fallon's turn as host was eclipsed by just about everyone. The film critic Karen Krzanovich is here. Karen, your thoughts?
Well, he can't sing. Jimmy Fallon cannot hold a note.
Therefore, he should not be there.
it's quite funny. I think singing off-key is actually acceptable and endearing, particularly in Hollywood. It's real poison chalice to host any Hollywood award show.
It is, but then when you do it well, people will worship you for it. I feel like...
For a year, maybe.
Well, if it hadn't been for getting up and hosting these awards ceremonies, Neil Patrick Harris might not have had the career renaissance that he's had.
It's quite possible, although he is highly skilled. I've seen him jump through a hoop. literally jump through a hoop. Actually, do you remember when he did that? He did that diving. Anyway, don't get me started. I agree. It's death by the sword if you don't do it well. I mean, some of the best comedians, some of the best hosts have gone down in flames. So he has every right to be nervous, Jimmy Fallon, even though he's very, very experienced on television and live television. Teleprompter went down right away, so you know it's the astrologers should be going, yes, I know, because it was Mercury retrograde. Never mind. What I think is really interesting and what we're all waiting for is not only did our favorite people win, but what are they going to say in their moments? Now, these were very, very tightly scheduled acceptance speeches.
And yet we all sort of expect the unexpected when we watch the Golden Globes because we know it's not the Oscars and the whole point of them existing, well, maybe not the whole point, but one of the large reasons we like to tune in, some of us, is because it's a little bit more interesting. It's a little bit more fun. There are a few drinks being had around nice big dinner tables.
Well, like Jimmy Fallon was singing along to the La La Land song. He was singing City of Stars. They've been drunk by three or something like that. They've all been drinking since three or something like that. So, yeah, everybody's pretty hammered. And it is relaxed, and it is the Hollywood foreign press. So it's the foreign press. It's supposed to be the world in Hollywood making these decisions. Of course, it isn't. It's a motley bunch of journalists.
Yeah, exactly. That's why we know. It's not an award ceremony. It's really a popularity contest.
It is. It's Hollywood giving itself a pat on the back.
It only makes sense that the Golden Globes, being an out and proud popularity contest, would have something to say about that other popularity contest known as the U.S. election.
Yes. Absolutely right. And Meryl Streep's honorary lifetime award incurred a lengthy and I thought quite good take on the political situation in America, where she was very disturbed that Donald Trump had apparently imitated a disabled journalist early. And she said that really floored her. And she was hoarse from, I think, crying probably at Carrie Fisher's funeral. That's the impression you were given. But there were a lot of very political acceptance speeches. Tom Hiddleston, who won for The Night Manager, was talking about his work in Sudan and how arms trade was going on there.
A quick story. I know it's been a long night, but I recently went to South Sudan, which is the youngest country in the world in East Africa, with the United Nations Children's Fund. I do a little bit of work with them, try to help spread the word as best I can. There's a terrible situation happening for children. The Night Manager is about arms dealing, and there are far too many arms going into South Sudan. But there's a curfew at 6 p.m. every night because humanitarian aid workers have to be inside so that it's safe by 6. And one night we were having a bite to eat at the canteen where we were staying. And a group of young men and women tottered over to the table, and we were all having what they call a dirty beer in humanitarian language. And they were a group of Médecins Sans Frontières, doctors and nurses. And they wanted to say hello because during the shelling in the previous month, they had binge-watched the night manager. And the idea that I could provide, or that we could provide some relief and entertainment for the people who work for UNICEF and Médecins Sans Frontières and the World Food Programme, who are fixing the world in the places where it is broken, made me immensely proud. So I dedicate this to those out there who are doing their best. Thank you.
Hugh Laurie was saying that this is probably the last Golden Globes because anything having to do with foreign and press will be suppressed. And people were making very, very political. And they can do it because, as you said, it's not as important as the Oscars.
And but even so, people do get political at the Oscars sometimes as well.
All the time.
But it sometimes doesn't go down very well. I do remember quite a few years ago, Michael Moore obviously getting political when he accepted his Oscar. He faced a lot of boos in the crowd. I think that was actually still when George W. Bush was in the White House. But I mean, look, that's ridiculous as well. You're rewarding someone for making a political documentary. Of course they're going to be political. How do you feel, though, when people who are not outwardly political, Meryl Streep is an actress, she's a celebrity. Mm-hmm. We may have enjoyed her rousing speech, but, you know, what's she doing up there talking about politics? Some people will say that. What do you think?
She's a private individual. She can tweet. She can say what she likes. That's the wonder of my country. She has millions and millions and millions of people know her name, and they will listen to what she's got to say. And so she is a valuable platform for any message. I feel comfortable with her views, whatever the views are. I separate somebody's politics from their art. And that's maybe hypocritical, but it keeps it safe for me. People were rolling their eyes a bit at various speeches because I think when we're talking about entertainment, we don't want to taint it, quote unquote, with politics. Of course, with movies like, you know, I, Daniel Blake would be difficult, or as the Michael Moore documentary, as you said.
Exactly.
It is very difficult to separate politics and creativity, but in Hollywood, it's safer to do that. It's safer just to say, I loved working with you.
Who are we? And you know, what is Hollywood anyway? It's just a bunch of people from other places. I was born and raised and educated in the public schools of New Jersey. Viola was born in a sharecropper's cabin in South Carolina, came up in Central Falls, Rhode Island. Sarah Paulson was born in Florida, raised by a single mom in Brooklyn. Sarah Jessica Parker was one of seven or eight kids from Ohio. Amy Adams was born in Vicenza, Veneto, Italy. And Natalie Portman was born in Jerusalem. Where are their birth certificates? They gave me 3 seconds to say this, so. An actor's only job is to enter the lives of people who are different from us and let you feel what that feels like. And there were many, many, many powerful performances this year that did exactly that. Breathtaking, compassionate work. But there was one performance this year that stunned me. It sank its hooks in my heart. Not because it was good. There was nothing good about it. But it was effective and it did its job. It made its intended audience laugh and show their teeth. It was that moment when the person asking to sit in the most respected seat in our country imitated a disabled reporter, someone he outranked in privilege, power, and the capacity to fight back. It kind of broke my heart when I saw it, and I still can't get it out of my head because it wasn't in a movie. It was real life. And this instinct to humiliate when it's modeled by someone in the public platform, by someone powerful. It filters down into everybody's life because it kind of gives permission for other people to do the same thing.
Looking at what happened at the Golden Globes, brush them aside all you like, but it's impossible to now look at the Oscars and think La La Land is not going to be the darling of that ceremony now as well. A record-breaking 7 awards, taking away everything it was nominated for.
Oh, that's right.
Is this film an instant classic?
Well, you have to remember that no longer, the Golden Globes used to be the real forerunner of the Oscars. That's no longer statistically true. There are things that are actors and actresses that have won big at the Globes and haven't won an Oscar. So Los Angeles, Hollywood needs to buck itself up, especially now in this era of political and creative uncertainty. This is a film that stars some very beloved actors. It's got some wonderful lyrical moments. It's pretty easy to understand. It's about trying to succeed in Hollywood, and why wouldn't Hollywood love that? So, yes, I don't think it's going to do as well at the Oscars because I don't think it's that kind of a film. They're saying that this is bringing back the era of the musical. Now, if you, you've seen La La Land.
How many times have people said that this is bringing back the era?
Of the Western, of the science fiction, of the horror.
But let's forget that not that long ago we had Chicago that did exceptionally well. We've had Les Mis doing exceptionally well. Mm. Musicals can do well. They don't necessarily bring about any great change because, you know, Hollywood is a town that doesn't really learn from anything, isn't it?
No, that's true. If you look at the way, I mean, Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone have done a really, really good job of dancing. But when you put them side by side, let's say to Debbie Reynolds, or to Fred Astaire, Gene Kelly. No. You know, you just think, wow, it just looks like a cakewalk there, you know, just taking a little step.
You know what? Fred Astaire wouldn't even get through the audition process in this day and age.
Probably wouldn't. No.
I sound like my grandmother saying that, but, you know, Granny's right.
We had faces then, as that Tumblr goes. But it's a lyrical, wonderful film. The opening sequence is amazing. The tunes are very catchy. And it's colorful and it's upbeat. Even in a town where, you know, if you're 20, you're too old.
City of stars, are you shining just for me? City of stars.
La La Land is out in many cinemas around the world right now. Other winners of the night at the Golden Globes included Moonlight, which took away the award for Best Drama. Isabelle Huppert was named Best Actress in a Drama for her role in Elle, which also scored Best Foreign Language Film. And Aaron Taylor-Johnson scored a Best Supporting Actor award for his chilling performance in Nocturnal Animals. Oh, and the song you're hearing right now, well, that's City of Stars from La La Land, which was named Best Original Song. This is The Cinema Show, back in a moment.
Do you like bad movies? No, neither do we. But don't worry, we've discovered a cure for bad films. It's called MUBI.
Sometimes Wells's films aren't very nourishing, they're very exciting. Citizen Kane, I think, absolutely wins the competition for the film that has made more people want to become a filmmaker than any other.
Every day, MUBI adds a new must-see film to its carefully curated selection. No junk-filled mess or endless scrolling. Just an assembly of the best movies from all over the world waiting to be devoured. To sample a whole month of movies for free, just head over to MUBI.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. Hurry now, the film's about to start.
You're listening to The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. Despite being born in the United States, Eugene Green has made a name for himself in the international cinema world. But the man behind acclaimed titles such as The Portuguese Nun, La Sapienza, and most recently The Son of Joseph, prefers not to be reminded of his early American years. His latest film tells the story of a 15-year-old, Vincent, who feels quite separate from his school friends who prefer to spend their time torturing rats or selling sperm on the internet. Living with his single mother, he embarks on an investigation all of his own to find out who his father is.
J'ai une question à te poser.
Oui.
Qui est mon père?
Tu sais déjà la réponse. Je te réponds aujourd'hui comme toujours. Tu n'as pas de père.
The Son of Joseph is screening right now on MUBI. Monocle's Yolene Goffin dialed up Eugene Green at his home in France, where they discussed some of the inspiration behind his films.
I never try to imitate any sort of visual. I have a pictorial culture. I studied art history and I'm interested in painting and, of course, in cinema, also I have a cinema culture, but I never tried to duplicate paintings or other films. So I really can't talk about, I really don't have very much to say about that.
And is there no one like from an early age that inspired you, artists or individuals?
In a general way, but I don't try to copy paintings. Of course, I'm very interested in Renaissance and Baroque painting and architecture. And people always are looking for influences as if they were copies or something. But it's part of my culture. But culture, I always say, it's like the human body is the result of what you have eaten, actually. But when you look at someone, you don't see a carrot or a steak on his forehead. It's been assimilated. And visual culture, I think it's the same thing.
I'm also very fascinated by, the reference to French theater, or how you use rhythm and words in the way of expressing emotion or no emotion. So I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, how you use language.
Yes, except that people talk about, I've read that, I've been in my films, people speak as in French Baroque theater, and that's completely false, of course. I did, of course, do work on Baroque theater. But in cinema, I try to do something with the words, but it's specifically cinematographical. I write the dialogue so that I try to get a maximum of strong emotions and a minimum of words. And I ask the actors to speak as if they were speaking to themselves. So it's the opposite of what you do in theater, where everything is amplified. If you speak to yourself, you don't use any rhetorical effects. You don't make any rhetorical effects. And I want just the words to touch them, because what I'm looking for in cinema is the hidden interiority of the people, actually, the actors, but the actors are people. That explains the rather particular way that I have the actors act.
And how do you blend your visual decisions then with the story and with that technique? Because you're a writer and a director. Do you ever find it difficult to merge those two things into a cinematic story?
No, not at all, because when I write the script, I see the film in my head. And so all the dialogue is conceived in relationship to shots, which I've already visualized in my imagination. And I always work with the same cinematographer, Raphael Auburn, who is very good and who understands perfectly what I want to do. And what I try to do in the visual concept is to eliminate everything which is not essential. If there, for example, if there's just one character in the frame, I usually place him symmetrically, and the whole frame is actually symmetrical. And if you see things behind the character, I want them to contribute to his physical presence. The main principle for me in the visual composition is to eliminate everything which is not essential and to only show the essential.
The filmmaker Eugene Green speaking to Monocle's Yolene Goffin. And finally today, if a song and dance in Los Angeles isn't quite your thing, well, don't cry. Perhaps we can tempt you with a tune from old Argentina.
It won't be easy. You'll think it's strange when I try to explain how I feel. That I still need your love after all that I've done. You won't believe.
It's been just over 20 years since Madonna took on the sought-after role of Eva Perón in Evita, based, of course, upon the stage musical by Tim Rice and Andrew Lloyd Webber. Many of us have seen the film and can easily recall that triumphant scene on the balcony, but far fewer have been lucky enough to see the actual building in Buenos Aires where that moment of history took place, and fewer still have stood on the balcony itself. Monocle's Georgina Godwin has done exactly that, and she's just returned from Argentina and joins me now. Georgina, how on earth did you come to be in the office of Eva Perón?
Well, I, like most people, have been aware of Eva Peron, or Evita, of course popularised by the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical and then the film starring Madonna. But I'd never really felt any kind of emotion about it. And then when I went to Buenos Aires, the first thing that struck me was that whilst lying in the bath in my hotel room, you could see a building with a mural of Evita on the side of it. And this was apparently where she'd given her last speech. So I looked at a YouTube video of her last speech, now having read up on some of her history. And it was where she was refusing the vice presidency, which her husband had tried to give her, and saying to the people, which there were hundreds of thousands of them, the whole street was full of them, saying to them, I didn't do it for power, I didn't do it for money, I did it for love, I did it for you. And in the YouTube video, you can see her turn around and just collapse on her husband, on General Perón. And we know now, of course, that that was because she knew that she had terminal cervical cancer, that she knew she was going to die. It's just so sad when you look at that footage now. So I was at the Kirchner Cultural Centre, as it's called now. It used to be the old post office, involved with a show there, which meant that we were with the woman that ran the building and had the keys. And for the last 3 months of Evita's life, her office was based in this building. And so what they've done is they've recreated it. It's more like an artist's installation, I suppose, than an exact reproduction or a museum of the office. But all of her documents are there, piles of letters, all these toys that she collected for children. The foundation was to help poor people, particularly children. And of course, outside of that, you walk out through the glass doors and there is the balcony on which she stood.
The balcony on which we would all know that very famous scene from the movie, and of course the many pictures and footage as well that exists of that moment. But you actually stood there.
I did, and I have to say, I'm afraid I couldn't help myself. I had to raise my arms in the air.
I saw the pictures, yes.
And do a little bar of a new Argentina under my breath. I was singing on the balcony.
So I was looking at some of your pictures of inside this, as you described it, the art installation. It's interesting the way they've set out some of the artefacts here. There was a large pile of letters, which is meant to symbolise all of the letters that she would receive just constantly, just a constant flood of fan mail.
And, you know, people write to her still. I went to her grave in the amazing Recoleta Cemetery, which is like a small city. It's so huge. And there's the Duarte family grave, and there are little letters poked in there because there is this huge cult of Evita. People, Saint Evita, they call her Santa Evita, and they want her, need her to help them. It's desperate people who want this help. So as you say, yes, this whole pile of letters, sort of stamps, her handwritten documents. There's even her jacket over the back of a chair. It's enormously evocative.
I always find that when you can have contact with these sorts of mythical legends from afar. You can see the movies, you can read the books, but then when you visit some sort of location where that gives you some sort of connection with that in the real world, it changes it, doesn't it? You feel as though somehow, even though you always knew it was real, it somehow feels more authentic, more real.
Absolutely. As I say, it used to be an Andrew Lloyd Webber musical to me. But now she feels like this living, breathing person. And I was prompted to read up on a lot of her history. And like, for instance, her body was shipped out of Argentina because they were very afraid that it would become a centre for sort of martyr, you know, because obviously what happened then was you had the military takeover and Evita and everything she stood for was very much pushed to one side. But her body is now back in the country. And it is very, very real and just so moving to see how real she is to the people there in their everyday lives.
Don't cry for me, Argentina. The truth is, I never left you. All through my wild days, my mad existence, I kept my promise. Don't keep your distance.
Monocle's Georgina Godwin. She's the host of Meet the Writers here on Monocle 24, which this week brings you an Argentine special dedicated to the literary scene in beautiful Buenos Aires. Keep an eye out for the podcast. And that's it for this week's program. Today's show was edited by Kieran Matthew Banerjee and Claire Crofton and researched by Yolene Goffin. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast wherever you happen to get your audio, and The Cinema Show will be back next week. I'm Ben Rylan. Thanks for listening.
They promised to be, the answer was here all the time. I love you and hope you love me.
don't cry for me, Argentina.